so hard to describe music other than the basic way to describe it. Music is basically melody, harmony, and rhythm. But, I mean, people can do much more with music than that. It can be very descriptive in all kinds of ways, you know, all walks of life.
He was one of those rare artists who seemed to come out of nowhere and captivate his peers and fans so quickly, so completely, that before they knew what hit them, the world was changed forever. I'm Nancy Wilson, and welcome to Jazz Profiles. In this hour, part two of our tribute to the legendary alto saxophonist, Charlie Parker. Just a few short years after Charlie Parker left his home in Kansas City, he became a founder and role model for the emerging modern jazz movement called bebop. In New York, during the 40s, they not only wanted to play like him, they wanted to talk like him, walk like him, and live like him, for better and for worse. By the time he and Dizzy Gillespie completed their first sojourn in Los Angeles, Parker's heroin addiction and alcohol abuse had flared wildly out of control, and he was hospitalized for 6 months. When he would finally be released from the mental hospital at Camarillo, he would return to New York City, fresh, alert, and ready to take his place at the head of a growing parade of artists and intellectuals who were proclaiming a brave new day in American culture. Writer Gary Giddens.
Charlie Parker was a superstar among musicians. The irony is that he was never widely known to the general public.
Baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan.
When I first heard Charlie Parker, it had a profound effect on how I perceived music altogether. This was because Bird had a unique approach to rhythm, and it was so much in control.
Alto saxophonist Charles McPherson.
I think the first tune that I heard Bird play was Tico Tico. And from that point on, I was just blown away, you know. And I was about 14. And I immediately understood. I mean, immediately it made perfect sense to me.
Trumpeter Wynton Marsalis.
Well, the first time I heard Charlie Parker, I was about 12 or 13. It was right when I was getting into jazz, and I didn't really know anything about the musicians, but I knew when I heard him on the radio, it was doodle-lip-a-dip, boop-a-dip-lip, bibbidi-bidi-bidi-bop, wee-da, boo-doo-boo-doo-bidoo-bidoo-dee. So I knew when I heard that, whoever he was the best at it. It's just the confidence that he played with and the flow of it, the perfection of it, and also the soul of it.
Aspiring young alto saxophonist named Jackie McLean recalls seeing Charlie Parker for the first time.
The first time I heard him in person, he was playing with Dizzy's Big Band at the McKinley Theater in the Bronx. And a bunch of us went to that theater and rushed to the front row to listen, to wait and see this man. And it was incredible when he walked out of that reed section and walked up to the microphone, and I really saw him play for the first time and heard that sound coming over the microphone. It was incredible. It just changed my whole life, and it did that to a lot of people.
Then there were musicians who literally copied everything Charlie Parker did.
When Bird came out with a record, everybody waited for that record to come out and put it on and immediately find how many things you can take off of it that you can use next week at the jam session. and blow over everybody, you know. I mean, that's what we used to do, man. I used to try to get down all of Bird's latest stuff. But the we found a way to, Sonny Rollins and myself, some other guys in my neighborhood. There was one kid who had a wire recorder. He could record off of the radio. And Bird and had his band coming from a live broadcast on Friday and Saturday night from the Royal Roost. And so you had a chance to hear Bird play for an hour live from the club. So as my friend across the street would record all this stuff, then he would charge us $2 each for a disc. And we would be lined up at his house the next day, you know, getting the disc to go back to the house and play things now that nobody else in New York could play unless they had wire recorders to take this stuff off the radio. And I think we were the only ones because we were finding some new, fresh ideas that Bird was playing that were unrecorded.
Parker's day at the Camarillo Hospital near Los Angeles ended in early 1947. The doctors there had found him a charming, intelligent patient. Bird himself felt renewed. Although he was anxious to get back to New York City, he took time to record two more dates for Dial Records before departing. The last one featured pianist Errol Garner. He'd yielded the song Cool Blues. Charlie Parker with the Errol Garner Trio. After this final California session for Dial, Parker returned to New York in the spring of 1947, nearly a year and a half after he had arrived in California. When he stepped off the plane in New York, he was feeling strong, and there was a new maturity about him. The music that he helped pioneer, that seemed so radical a few years ago, was now being accepted by a wide range of fans and critics. He was becoming a big name. It was the beginning of the end of his most prolific period. Just a couple of months after Charlie Parker's return to New York and his arrival as a star, he had his formal debut at Carnegie Hall in a reunion with colleague Dizzy Gillespie. Charlie Parker anthem, Coco, recorded on September 29, 1947, in Carnegie Hall. With Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, John Lewis on piano, Al McKibben on bass, and Joe Harris drums. Parker's first few months back in the Big Apple were a celebration. Wherever he went, he was greeted as a returning hero. He enjoyed this period immensely, perhaps too much. For his old drug connections welcomed him back as enthusiastically as did the jazz musicians. Eventually, Parker realized that his new fame meant he could not only demand higher fees, but for the first time, could finally put together his own working unit, Charlie Parker.
I came back again to New York in 47, the early part of 47, and that's when I decided to have a band of my own permanently.
Parker favored the quintet, with sax and trumpet up front, piano, bass, and drums in the rhythm section. Although this format had been used back at Minton's Playhouse and the Three Deuces, Bird's choice led to the quintet being accepted as a standard jazz combo to this day. Gary Giddens.
I think Parker, in a sense, codified the modern jazz group as a quintet. Two winds, three rhythm instruments. In his hands, and I think in a number of musicians in that period, it had a certain purity of form, much like a string quartet. There's no waste. Everybody's got a very specific role to play.
Writer and critic Stanley Crouch.
Parker had two things going. One of them was that he had an extra horn because he had become accustomed to that, I believe, playing with Dizzy Gillespie. The other one was that he needed somebody to be there to stand up at the microphone and play if he got there two or three sets late. So I think it was both aesthetic and functional.
For musicians, he chose some familiar faces to play with. They included drummer Max Roach, who would remain with him through most of the quintet period, bassist Tommy Potter or Curly Russell, pianists Bud Powell, John Lewis, or Duke Jordan. But on trumpet, there was a surprise. An unpolished young man from St. Louis named Miles Davis. Some didn't understand why Charlie Parker, the leading voice of modern jazz, chose Miles. For one thing, his sound was tentative and a little hesitant, the antithesis of Dizzy Gillespie.
His sound was a beautiful foil to Charlie Parker's sound.
Gary Giddens.
Instead of playing in the upper register where Dizzy was, he played in the middle and lower middle register. He played longer notes. He's very lyrical. I mean, even if you listen to the very first record they did together, Now's the Time, when everybody was attacking Miles, he couldn't swing, he didn't have chops, blah, blah, blah. The fact is that Miles' solo, for pure lyricism, is actually more melodic than Charlie Parker's brilliant, you know, impeccably played solo.
In addition to picking up regular work for the quintet along New York's 52nd Street, Parker brought the group into the recording studio virtually every other month, cutting sides for Savoy Records and fulfilling his obligation to Ross Russell's Dial Records. Parker continued to write and record tunes based on the changes of familiar standards. It was a necessary practice in part because the smaller companies like Savoy and Dial did not want to pay the royalties due for recording the original standards. On this tune, for instance, Back Home in Indiana was refashioned into Donna Lee. Instead of recording Fats Waller's song, Honeysuckle Rose, Parker borrowed the chord changes and wrote his own melody. The result became another classic. Thank you.
Charlie Parker's Scrapple from the Apple, with Miles Davis on trumpet, Duke Jordan at the piano, Tommy Potter on bass, Max Roach on drums, and Charlie Parker on alto saxophone. Phil Schaap.
Ben Webster heard that record, bought it, walked out of the record store. Another copy of the record was now being played by the proprietor of the record store through the sound speaker onto the street, and Webster was hearing it again, and he lunged out at the speaker with his arms wide open in an enthusiastic response, saying, "He's playing Tatum on the saxophone."
You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to alto saxophonist Charlie Parker. I'm Nancy Wilson. Musicians have long known that it is equally difficult, perhaps more difficult, to play slow than fast. And Bird was a master of ballads, like Embraceable You. Gary Giddens.
Now, on Embraceable You, which is an even more extraordinary solo, one of the really extraordinary ballad performances in jazz history, he doesn't play one note. Not one note of George Gershwin's melody. I mean, it is a real tour de force. From the very beginning, he invents. It's one thing to invent something, you know, that's very fast, but he invents his own melody, and he sustains it for the entire 32 bars of the chorus. Now, that one he could have called anything. I mean, most people don't even recognize it's Embraceable You until they're told, but that one he insisted on calling Embraceable You and giving to Gershwin. And I can only speculate, but my suspicion is he just wanted to make everybody aware of what he had pulled off, even if it did cost them royalties.
Charlie Parker on alto saxophone and Miles Davis on trumpet with Embraceable You, recorded in New York City in October of 1947. In 1949, Charlie Parker took his classic quintet to Paris. This trip was a jewel in his crown. For while he was a hero to musicians in the United States, he still remained relatively unknown to the rest of the population. In France, however, it was a whole other story.
The peanuts. Now he goes to Paris.
Gary Giddens.
And he's standing on this huge stage, and the place is packed. And they're standing and screaming and yelling. And no matter what he does, the screaming is just louder. And I think, you know, in a way, it hurt him in the long run, because I think he never got over the triumph that he had in Paris as compared to the existence he was leading in New York.
Charlie Parker's wife from the mid-40s to the early 50s, Doris Parker.
That was the most wonderful time of his life. He had never, ever been treated the way he was treated there. And Americans don't treat their jazz musicians. You have to understand, at that time, jazz musicians were probably a shade below garbage. And black musicians were a shade below that. So in the United States, they have never revered jazz as they do in Europe. So when he went there, people knew where he went to school. They knew all about his early career. They knew his birthday. They knew everything. He couldn't get over that, that he was treated as an artist. He had never been treated like that before in his life. You know, he came back, he was absolutely glowing about it. He said it was just an amazing period of his life.
Salt Peanuts, recorded in Paris in 1949, with Charlie Parker, Max Roach, Duke Jordan on piano, and a new member to the ensemble, trumpeter Red Rodney. Although Parker's reception in Paris was never equaled in the United States, he was treated with more respect when he returned home from Europe. Shortly thereafter, the most famous jazz club in history opened in New York City, and it was named for him, Birdland. That's just ahead. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to a tribute to Charlie Parker on Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio. Birdland was a classic 52nd Street club. The room was accented with bird cages, and the MC was a midget named Pee-wee Marquette, who was known for mispronouncing the musicians' names, unless, of course, they tipped him a few dollars each night. The room was divided into two sections, with the more elegant tables on the right and the bleachers for underage patrons on the left. Charlie Parker was in and out of this club for the next 4 years, performing with his own ensembles and with all-star groups featuring trumpet players Dizzy Gillespie and Fats Navarro, pianists Bud Powell, John Lewis, Duke Jordan, Al Haig, and Walter Bishop Jr., bassists Tommy Potter or Curly Russell, and drummers Max Roach and later Roy Haynes. Many of Charlie Parker's appearances at Birdland were broadcast on radio and preserved by Boris Rose, an amateur recording buff. Here's a sample from that collection featuring the nation's most popular jazz announcer, Symphony Sid.
You know, I just a little while ago, while the bars were playing, were saying, I was standing at the bar. I was talking to Terry Gibbs. He said to me, just like I've been saying to you for the past few days, it never in life again probably will happen where you can get three great gentlemen of modern music, guys like Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and Bud Powell, Roy Haynes, and Tommy Potter all together in one group. And don't forget, make it here at Birdland, the jazz corner of the world, Broadway, 52nd Street, dollar admission. How can you go wrong? Right now, ladies and gentlemen, a thing that was originally written by the high priest of Bop, Thelonious Monk, as done by Bird, Dizzy, the fellas, round about midnight.
Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, performing as part of a radio broadcast from Birdland on May 9, 1953. While Birdland was one sign of Charlie Parker's growing fame, another sign arrived in the form of an invitation from jazz impresario Norman Granz. He often hired Bird to play at his Jazz at the Philharmonic series, and now he was the messenger that gave Parker the chance to fulfill one of his dreams, to record with strings. Record producer and jazz impresario, Norman Granz.
I don't know how many sides I did with Bird of the quartet arrangement, and he had done many, many sides for other companies before me. And after a while, he would get bored because there's just so many blues you can play. So I said to Charlie, why don't we get some big standards and do an album? And he said, can I have strings? And I said, yes, you can. And so that was how the string thing came up with Charlie Parker.
Because of the size and complexity of the project, Norman Granz turned for help to the artist and repertoire director of Mercury Records, a young classically trained oboist who would eventually have America singing along with him. His name, Mitch Miller.
And so Norman came to me and asked me to find the best strings. And, of course, he found the best jazz players. The best jazz players, there's Ray Brown, there was Buddy Rich, and Stan Freeman. Then I got the top symphonic strings, Max Hollander, who was associate concertmaster of NBC, Eddie Vito, who was principal harpist at NBC, and all the string players from the symphony orchestras. And we were going to do this all in the one day. And I got Jimmy Carroll, or Jigsy as we called him, to do the arrangements, the background arrangements.
After Jimmy Carroll hastily assembled the arrangements and Mitch Miller had contracted the string players, the day of the first session arrived.
We got the orchestra in there and we began to rehearse, as you used to say in those days, for balance. So we were on about the fifth one. And by the way, I'm not playing in these the first time around. Then Charlie walks in. He's carrying his axe under his arm, and he looks around, and he hears it, and he looks from side to side, his eye almost bug-eyed. And he then turns around and goes out. So I figured he went to the men's room or something, or went to see Norman in the control room. And suddenly I said, we're ready for a take. Where's Charlie? No Charlie. He just walked out. So we dismissed the guys. And there was no recording with Parker. So we all go home. And I don't know if it was a week, 10 days later, Norman calls up and says, we found him. And I said, why'd he walk out? He says, it was too beautiful. He couldn't stand it. He just couldn't stand it to play alone in something like that, something that was so evocative and beautiful. So Norman, out of a clear sky, says, I'll get Mitch to play with you. Parker says, okay. And then he tells me, I don't improvise. What do? I go to Jigsy Carroll, and I say, write a sketch, and don't write too much. Just a relief of the color, and I'll play around it. And try to give it to me beforehand, you know, because, I'd give my right arm to improvise, but I never could. And we start to record. I'm telling you, everything was first take except two. And we'd made 12 sides. All were first take except two, which were second take.
Of all the songs that Bird recorded at that session with strings, perhaps the best known, and the one that's considered the most successful by fans and musicians alike, was the ballad, Just Friends. Just Friends, with Charlie Parker and strings, recorded in New York on November 30th, 1949. Doris Parker.
He loved it, and he worked on that album, and they were very careful choosing their numbers, and Charlie always liked ballads. He liked the blues, and he just was so excited about that record. I know he was always sorry it wasn't a bigger success than it was.
He may have been disappointed that the record was not a bigger hit with fans and critics, but commercially, it was the most successful album Parker ever made. And although it polarized the jazz community, many of his followers loved hearing him with strings. Alto saxophonist Jackie McLean.
It was just heavenly. I mean, he gave up nothing to do that. I mean, he didn't sell anything short. He didn't commercialize his style or alter his concept of ideas to do the thing. You know, when he played those beautiful songs, Summertime and If I Should Lose You, all the most beautiful things, I cried, man. It brought tears to my eyes. Everything happens to me. I mean, it was like he was telling the story of his life. I mean, it was coming out of the sound of the instrument. It was just awesome.
The critics, on the other hand, were unanimous in their decision that Byrd sold out. They felt the arrangements were beneath him, and they concluded that he had done it for money rather than the beauty. Norman Granz.
If I had had Byrd on a separate track and taken out all the rest of it, then these same people would say he played his ass off. But there's that blindness about hearing a great musician in a different setting.
One major, if unintended, consequence of Charlie Parker with strings was that it broke up Byrd's working quintet. The public wanted to hear and see him as he had appeared on the record. So the quintet was dissolved, and the group Parker with Strings was created. After opening at Birdland, they survived the acid test at Harlem's Apollo Theater, and they took their victory lap at Carnegie Hall, the legendary Midnight at Carnegie recording. Rocker, composed by Jerry Mulligan, with Charlie Parker and strings, recorded in September of 1950 at Carnegie Hall. Producer, Phil Shapp.
An illustration of the very point that those who challenged Byrd about the strings deal were making. They weren't happy with Jimmy Carroll's charts. He was a Mitch Miller man. Jerry Mulligan, however, was a jazz man and did a better chart. Rocker also facilitated one of the things that Norman Granz thought that the Parker with Strings package needed, a little bit more of a wallop, more up-tempos. And Rocker, in fact, was used to close the show at the legendary Midnight at Carnegie.
Parker continued touring with Strings for 2 years to diminishing reviews. By the end, the bookings became as thin as the audience. And Byrd finally abandoned the format to begin a period of searching for a new, more fertile field to work. One place he looked to was the exotic rhythms from south of the border. Despite the hard knocks he was taking from critics, especially in a changing nightclub environment, Parker continued to push himself. Artistically, he never shied away from a challenge. One of those challenges that clearly illustrates that Byrd was still at the peak of his creativity was billed the greatest concert ever. From Massey Hall in Toronto, Canada, in May of 1953, here is trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie, pianist Bud Powell, drummer Max Roach, and bassist Charlie Mingus with Salt Peanuts.
Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts. salt peanuts, salt peanuts. Salt peanuts, salt peanuts. Salt peanuts. Salt peanuts, salt peanuts. The name of the salt. Salt peanuts, salt peanuts.
Salt Peanuts with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, back in the familiar environment of the classic quintet. Bud Powell on piano, Charlie Mingus on bass, and Max Roach on drums. Recorded on May 15, 1953, at Massey Hall in Toronto, Canada. As the mid-1950s approached, it was clear to everyone that the musical landscape was changing. The bebop revolution had become the accepted way of thinking. As it became more popular, it also became more commercial and less tolerant of erratic behavior. As the pioneers became the lame ducks, the hunters became the hunted. In this rare interview with saxophonist Paul Desmond and broadcaster John McClellan, it's clear that Charlie Parker was searching for his place.
I'm glad it finally blew over, of a sort. And I do mean of a sort.
Mm.
Yeah, I enjoy this a little much more, in fact, and I have the pleasure to work with the same guys of a sort, and I've met other young fellows, you know, that come along. I enjoy working with them when I have the pleasure to, if I might say, you yourself.
Oh, thanks, Charlie.
Sure, I've had lots of fun working with you, man. It's a pleasure to know you. David Brubeck. Well, lots of other fellows have come along, you know, since that era, that particular era. It makes you feel that everything you did wasn't for naught, you know. That you really tried to prove something, and...
Well, man, you really proved it. I think you did more than anybody in the last 10 years to leave a decisive mark in the history of jazz.
Well, not yet, Paul, but I intend to. I'd like to study some more. I'm not quite through yet. I don't consider myself too old to learn.
No, I know many people are watching you at the moment with the greatest of interest to see what you're going to come up with next in the next few years, myself among the front row of them. And well, what have you got in mind? What are you going to be doing?
Well, seriously speaking, I mean, I'm going to try to go to Europe to study. I had the pleasure to meet one Edgar Varese in New York City. He's a classical composer from Europe. He's a Frenchman. Very nice fellow, and he wants to write for me some things for me for, you know, more or less on a serious basis, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if he takes me over, I mean, after he finishes with me, I might have a chance to go to Academie de Musicale in Paris itself and study, you know. And, well, my prime interest still is learning to play music, you know.
But Charlie Parker's dream of studying classical music with Edgar Varese would never be realized. By the winter of 1955, his heroin and alcohol addictions were taking their toll. He had developed a reputation for being an unreliable performer. He was even banned from Birdland, the club that was his namesake. Financially, he was nearly ruined. There had been at least one suicide attempt, and his daughter Pri had died while still a toddler, an event that left him totally distraught. Conductor, musician, and author Gunther Schuller recalls attending a party at the house of the Baroness Panonika van Koningswerter, or Nika as she was known to her jazz friends, shortly before Parker's death.
The last time I saw Parker was at a huge bash that the Baroness was giving for, I don't know, half of the jazz world down in one of her places down in the village. And everybody was there, and I must say that the amount of drugs and marijuana and the smoke in the rooms, and I'm telling you, was something unbelievable. And Parker sought me out because we had started to talk a few times about newer or modern or different developments in music, particularly in my primary area, namely classical music. And I realized that he was becoming kind of fascinated with what was going on in this other world. And so he grabbed me and he began to almost crying, almost pleading with me in sort of desperation, "Gunther, help me out. I want you to teach me about this other music." I mean, it was like a dying man. And, you know, he said, I'll call you, you know, and let's do this. And, of course, I think it was 2 months later he was dead.
Doris Parker.
I saw him a month before he died, and we had a long talk. He was getting ready to make some changes in his life. He was not well physically, and he was regretting some of the ways that he had handled his life. And he kind of, I felt from our talk, that he wanted to make peace.
Trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie.
One of my last meetings with Charlie Parker was him saying to me, "Save me." I thought about that a lot because he had been sick. And so my answer to him was that I said, yeah, nobody can save you. You have to do that yourself. There's nothing anyone can do with somebody who abuse themselves. He didn't abuse anybody else. He was the sweetest guy in the world. What he did to himself physically was a great sin.
Parker's death, like his life, is a subject of legend. He'd come to stay at the sumptuous apartment of his friend, the Baroness, to recuperate from an illness. He had been in residence there a few days and had an engagement in Boston coming up soon. While watching the Tommy Dorsey show on television one night, he began laughing at something on the screen, then choking, and then he collapsed. He died shortly thereafter, and the mystery surrounding the event has never been completely resolved. For some reason, his death was not reported to the press for 2 days. Likewise, the exact cause of death was never determined. There were just too many possibilities. A doctor at the morgue estimated his age to be mid to late 50s. He was, in fact, 34. Oddly, his coffin was nearly dropped by the pallbearers at his funeral and was prevented from hitting the ground only by the efforts of a blind pianist named Lenny Tristano. After the funeral in New York City, Charlie Parker's body was transported back to Kansas City, where it is interned to this day. Gary Giddens.
It was an ugly mockery, and yet then something really beautiful happened. Within a day of the word that he had died, all over New York you began to see the graffiti "Bird Lives," probably the most famous graffiti since Kilroy was here. And for years, I mean, when I was a kid, you'd occasionally see it. It was a way of a jazz fan making his mark on a wall was to write "Bird Lives."
No one could have known how true the words "Bird Lives" would turn out to be. The musical grammar that he pioneered is still, in John Hendrick's phrase, the highest form of talking ever invented. Today, you can hear his conventions and stylizations around the planet. It used to be considered exotic. Now it's even found in elevators and the musings of young hip-hoppers. Charlie Parker was larger than life at a time when jazz defined the boldest aspects of the American experience. Today, his music is the purest memory of what those times were about. The graffiti is gone, but the truth is undeniable. Bird lives. Our tribute to Charlie Parker was produced by Tim Owens. Our writer was Ben Sidran, with additional help from Phil Shapp. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. The post-production engineers were Bill McQuay, Soraya Muhammad, and Chuck Thompson. Our thanks to the NPR bureaus in London and New York City, Manoli Wetherill and Ken Poston. Stations KCUR in Kansas City, KPBS in San Diego, KLON in Long Beach, and WBGO in Newark also gave us a hand. Special thanks to Rachel Lewis at Verve Records and Daniel Marks at Denon Records. Thanks also to Dan Morgenstern and the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers State University. The executive producers for NPR's Jazz Profiles are Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. For more information about this and other programs in our series, look for us at NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Support for this program comes from a major grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, saying that jazz is as pure as the life we live. So live it. This is NPR, National Public Radio.